Okay, this is the lecture in the biochemistry unit on proteins, and we call this the molecules responsible for the diversity of life. And we all know from a previous bio course that DNA codes for proteins, or at least I hope you remember that. It's estimated now that there are anywhere between 20 and 25,000 genes in the human genome. The Human Genome Project was completed in 2003, and that's where this information comes from. So, and that's really, you know, it's really a neat number to know that that's how many genes we have. And we all know, hopefully, that a gene is simply a recipe for making a protein. So in very simple terms, we can say genes code for proteins. Really simple, okay? And I think you all know that. It's nothing new to you. But this may be new to you. It's estimated that there are anywhere from 500,000 to a million proteins in humans. Now, based on everything I've just told you, you see any problem here? Anyone have a problem with this? Yeah. Yeah, there's way fewer genes than there are proteins. So what does that mean? Yeah. That's right. Something must be happening to the genes. Maybe they're recombining, they're mixing things up in order to do this. And this was a huge surprise to researchers when they did the Human Genome Project. If you actually, there were like all these bets going on before the Human Genome Project was completed about how many genes there would be. And, you know, people had hundreds of thousands of genes were predicted because they knew that there were lots of proteins. And so when it finally came out to be somewhere between 20 and 24,000, it was pretty shocking to just about everybody. Everybody was surprised by this. And so it actually says a lot about how genes work. And one of the exciting things that we're finding is that genes are a lot more complicated than we ever imagined. You know, if we go back to sort of the Mendel's notion of what a gene is, that's pretty much old school. And the definition of what a gene is really kind of a moving target. And when we get to the molecular genetics section of our course, we're going to explore this. So kind of stay tuned for coming attractions. Well, you know, because genes code for proteins and there's, you know, anywhere up to a million different proteins, we can say that, you know, the diversity that we see in humankind is really due to the diversity of proteins. Pretty true. And if you want to say that proteins can be thought of as the molecule of life, that's really true. It's really amazing. And what I want to do now is I want to actually go through and list some of the things that proteins do that may be surprising to you. So let's kind of go to the next slide. First of all, structural support. Proteins, silk, I don't know if you know this, but silk is a protein. Collagen is a protein, and collagen is what is found in the ligaments and tendons in humans, okay? Storage of amino acids, egg white in embryos, that's protein. Casein in milk is a protein. Now, we've talked about the fact that milk has a carbohydrate in it, lactose, which is a disaccharide, so we know that, but it also has a protein in it as well. Transport of other substances. You may have heard of hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is a very complicated, very large protein found in red blood cells, and its function is simply to transport oxygen around the body. It takes it from the lungs and really delivers it to all the tissues. Every cell in the body receives oxygen from the hemoglobin, which is sort of the transporter of oxygen. Hormones. I don't know if you know this, but some proteins or some hormones are proteins. A great example of that would be insulin. We talked about insulin the other day, that it's this hormone that is made in the pancreas, and it helps all of us bring glucose from the blood into the cells. Insulin is a protein. Receptors of chemical signaling. So you'll remember my very first lecture in this series of lectures, I showed you two nerves and the synapse between them. And if you'll remember, there were these receptors in that slide. And the receptors that are embedded in the cell membrane, those are proteins as well. Contraction. Turns out that our muscles are made of two main proteins, actin and myosin, and these two proteins are what are responsible for muscle contraction. Enzymes, probably the most important, if you have to just name, like, what's the most important molecule in, besides water, in living organisms, we have to say it's enzymes. And enzymes are proteins, and their function is to speed up chemical reactions. And we're, in fact, an entire chapter of our book is devoted to enzymes. And you'll see why when we get to it. They're super important. Now, I'm at the end of this slide. We could go on for another 30 minutes and have a protein appreciation lecture. I could go on slide after slide after slide and show you. I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg of what proteins can do for you. And I could just go on and on and on. I'm not going to because we need to talk about other things today. But this just, you know, gives you kind of a sense of, wow, proteins are pretty important. They really are. They really are. Now, let's go to the next slide and look at the building blocks of proteins, which are amino acids. And if you look at amino acids, what I want to do is sort of break down an amino acid and show you how it's made so you can understand it. If you look at an amino acid, as you see here, in the very center of all amino acids is a carbon atom. That central carbon atom is surrounded by four things. Because remember, carbon atoms can form four bonds. And so we have four different things that are bonded. If you look on the left, you'll see that it's bonded to an amino group. And that's where the amino part of amino acid comes from. If you look on the right-hand side, you'll see a carboxylic acid group, and that's where the acid comes from. So we have an amino group on the left and a carboxylic acid group on the right. And then up top, we see a hydrogen atom. And then below, we see an R group. Now, let me just point something out to you. Every amino acid, and there are 20, we have 20 amino acids in humans. All of our proteins are made up of a combination of these 20 amino acids. Every one of our 20 amino acids is identical in the amino group, the little H up top, and the carboxyl group. That's the same in every amino acid. The only thing that's different is the R group down below. Okay, so that's really important. If you know that, you know that's a really good thing to remember. The other thing I want you to know is we have 20 different amino acids, and you can think of amino acids, it's sort of like an alphabet. Like we have, in the English language, we have 26 letters in our alphabet, and from those 26 letters, we can make up millions of words. You know, go to the Oxford English Dictionary if you want to see them all, okay? The same thing is true about amino acids and proteins. Amino acids are kind of like the alphabet of proteins. And so with these 20 different amino acids, you can combine them in different ways, and you can make up literally millions of proteins. So it's kind of, I think it's a pretty good analogy. And like I mentioned, what makes every amino acid different is the R group. So what we're going to do, let me talk about the importance of the R group. It turns out that the R group can be very simple. As you see in this next slide, on the bottom, you'll see glycine is the simplest amino acid because its R group is hydrogen. So it's really simple. Or the R group can be very complicated. As you can see on the right here, histidine has this crazy ring structure as part of its R group. Okay, very interesting. Now, like I said, the R group is the only thing that distinguishes the amino acids from one another. Because there's 20 different amino acids, there are 20 different R groups. And what's interesting about the R groups is they really dictate the chemistry of proteins. As you're going to see later in this lecture, it's really all about the R, you know, not exclusively, but it's pretty much a lot about the R groups. Now, the R groups, we can categorize them in three different categories. Number one, they can be nonpolar, and if they're nonpolar, they don't like water. So when they're in a protein, they're going to try to avoid water. Then there are a group of R groups that are polar, and therefore they're happy to be around water, and they're going to try to seek water. And then there's another group that are electrically charged, and therefore they're influenced by the pH of the solution. So these are kind of the three categories of R groups. And so what I'm going to do now is, in the next three slides, just sort of show you these. Now, you don't need to memorize these, okay? Don't get all freaked out like, oh my gosh, we've got to memorize all 20 amino acids and all their R groups. No, this is AP Bio. You don't have to do that. If you take a biochem class in college, you probably will have to know these R groups, but that will be probably a junior level or senior level course. But right now, all I'm just showing you is that, oh, look, we can categorize a bunch of the amino acids as nonpolar. And you can see in this slide that you've got in white all the R groups, and you can see that they're all different, but you can indeed see that they're all nonpolar. Okay? In the next slide, you can see all the polar R groups, and you'll notice that they all have OH, OH, SH, OH, NH2, NH2. You can see, you know, double bonded O. They've got, they are definitely polar. Okay? And then the final is the electrically charged R groups, and you can see in them that they all have some kind of ion, you know, O minus, NH3 plus, you know, and so forth. And some are acidic and some are basic. So those, that's how we categorize them. So just kind of, this is sort of like, just sort of appreciate the differences, okay? Okay. One of the things I'm going to do throughout this course is I'm going to be sort of entertaining you at times with science song parodies that, you know, sort of either I have written the lyrics to and I'll sing or have someone else sing, or I find them on the internet. And so we're going to have one right now. And this is based upon a Sarah McLachlan song called Building a Mystery. Maybe you're familiar with that song. And it's called Building a Histidine, and histidine is an amino acid. Now, what I'm going to do is give you one slide here that kind of gives you a little background so you'll appreciate some of the nuances of the song. So let me kind of read this off to you. I'm just going to kind of read this to you, and then we'll listen to the song. So first of all, histidine is an amino acid. It's one of the 20 found naturally in the human body. These amino acids can be linked together into long chains to form proteins. The process of manufacturing proteins out of amino acids is known as translation because a messenger RNA is translated into a sequence of amino acids. You probably remember this from a previous bio course. This takes place at intracellular structures called ribosomes. That's where proteins are made. In humans, some amino acids can be made from scratch, while others must be supplied by one's diet. The latter are collectively known as, quote-unquote, essential amino acids. Histidine is one such essential amino acid, at least in rodents and human infants. And there is some controversy as to whether adult humans can synthesize histidine. The song you're about to hear tells the fictional story of an unspecified organism for whom histidine is, in fact, essential. The organism's enzymes, tired of having to obtain histidine from dietary sources, decide to make it themselves. Not surprisingly, they meet with little success. Now, let me go through some jargon, because this is kind of written more at a biochem college level, and so it may go over your head. First of all, each amino acid has a unique R group, which we've just talked about, also known as the functional group or side chain. The R group of histidine is technically known as a imidazole ring, and I can't even say it. You shall say it in the song, you'll hear it. It has a pKa close to the normal pH of cytoplasm. Don't worry about that. Allowing it to buffer intracellular pH effectively. In other words, it's able to buffer this pH of the cell. Ribosome is a 5-carbon sugar from which a histidine is made. And finally, globins, or globins, however you want to say them, are histidine-rich proteins such as hemoglobin or myoglobin. Okay, with that as background, let us listen to Building a Histidine. And I just pulled this off the internet, so I had nothing to do with this song.
That's what the textbooks say, but you can't be subdued until the next meal. You've got some ribose and a few carbonyls, and you're going to take a break from your normal routine. You're building a histidine. You won't give up on the synthesis, though it's not going well. The R group buffers you, because it has the perfect pKa. Can you really create it without thermodynamics getting in the way? It's not difficult to form these amino acids. You're so clueless, maybe.
I think you get the idea. So I think she did a really nice job on that song. And she's actually got a really good voice, and they performed it quite well. So, okay. So with that as a little background, how do you make a protein? So we got 20 amino acids. What you do is you simply line them up, and you do a dehydration synthesis. You do a condensation reaction. And as you can see here, what we've got is we have 4 amino acids. We've lined them up, and you can see that the carboxylic acid on one combines with the amino group on the other, and you form water, and there you go. The bond between the amino acids is called a peptide bond. You'll need to know that, so make sure you know that it's a covalent bond. It's called a peptide bond. And the resulting polymer of these amino acids has a number of different names. They're all basically synonymous: a protein, a peptide, a polypeptide. Depends on who you read. Some books will call a short protein a peptide or a polypeptide. Some will just use all these terms synonymously. So just be aware that, depending on what you're reading, you may see different words used, but they kind of mean the same thing. It's a a sequence of amino acids linked together. Okay? Now, on this next slide, you can see the peptide bonds have now formed, and they're identified actually on the right there. You'll see it actually points to the peptide bond. So you've lost the water. Now you've got a covalent bond between each amino acid. And notice that on one end, you've got you've got an amino group hanging out. And on the other end, you've got a carboxylic acid hanging out. And so you call all polypeptides or all proteins will have what we call the amino end or the N-terminus. The other side will be the carboxyl end or the C-terminus. So just kind of remember that because every amino acid has that. And notice in this particular picture, the R groups are coming off the top of the molecule. In my previous pictures, they were coming off the bottom. So sometimes, you know, it depends on what the textbook authors want to do. They'll have the R groups coming up or going down. It doesn't really matter. And they're really responsible for the unique chemistry of these proteins, as I said before. And so, you know, like I say in my notes here, we might as well face it when you talk about proteins, what makes them unique. It's really all about the R groups. So with that said, we need to know more about these R groups. The next slide, really important. This is a key concept that's going to come up again and again and again throughout this course. Structure leads to function. And it turns out that proteins have four levels of structural complexity, which I'm going to go through in a few minutes. But what you need to know is that the structure of the protein is often responsible for the function of the protein. And the structure of proteins is due to the way these R groups interact with one another. And so here's what we can say. R groups determine structure. Structure determines function. And function is what makes the protein special. So that's how we put it all together. And you're going to see this as we go through our discussion of proteins in more detail. Now, before we do that, let me give you a quick overview of everything we've said so far. Up on the top of this slide, you'll see two amino acids. You'll see the carboxyl group on one, the amino group on the other, and you'll see that they come together and they form a peptide bond, and in the process, they lose water. That's a dehydration reaction or a condensation reaction. If you keep doing that over and over again, then you get a long chain of amino acids bound together by these peptide bonds, and that's what's called a protein. And once again, on the left side, you get what's called the N-terminus, that's the amino end, and on the right-hand side, you get the C-terminus, or the carboxyl end. At the bottom, you'll see an abbreviation of each of the amino acids. Every amino acid has a three-letter designation, and you can see it here going across. And there's eight, in this particular one, there's eight amino acids. And there's also, every amino acid also has a single letter designation as well, which you may see it depends on what you read. Okay, now I'm going to go through the different levels of structure, and this is really, really important. First of all, primary structure. This is the simplest. The primary structure is just the unique sequence of amino acids. It's what I showed you on the last slide at the bottom. You know, glycine was first, then, I don't know, serine, whatever. You know, they just go in a particular order. That's the primary structure. That's it. Now, the big question everyone asks themselves is, well, you know, what's the average, you know, protein, you know, how many amino acids is it? And it turns out that the average length of a protein is around 300 amino acids long. I got that a few years ago, but I haven't double-checked it. I just finished reading a book, which was sitting on the table here, about the human genome, and they have the latest number, and I don't know if it's 300 in the book. I have to double-check, maybe a little longer. But, I mean, you know, around 300, okay? This is just ballpark, okay? But they can be as long as, you know, 1,000 or more. You know, it can be much longer. Okay, secondary structure. Now we're getting more complicated. Okay, the secondary structure is what we call simple folding of the of the protein due to hydrogen bonding. And it's hydrogen bonding between the amino, what were the amino and the carboxyl groups, not between the R groups. That's critical. Make sure you know that, because the next level tertiary structure is between R groups. And secondary structure is not between R groups. It's between what was the amino and what was the carboxyl group, hydrogen bonding. Now, let's remember what hydrogen bonding is. I ask you to kind of reread chapter 3, make sure you know hydrogen bonding. It is critical. In biological systems, hydrogen bonding has so, it's so important. So let me explain how it works right here. Hydrogen bonding occurs when a hydrogen atom, which is covalently bonded to an electronegative atom, is attracted to another electronegative atom. Now, that may sound like a bunch of chemistry gobbledygook to you, and if it does, I recommend you go and read in Chapter 3 a little bit more about it, see some pictures, maybe go to the internet, go to Wikipedia, wherever you want to go, and read about hydrogen bonding. But that's the definition. The key idea here is that the hydrogen bond is a very weak bond. Okay? It's not a strong bond. It's not like a covalent bond at all. It can be easily ripped apart. In living systems, the electronegative partners are usually oxygen or nitrogen atoms, as you're going to see. And in proteins, the hydrogen bonding is between the double-bonded oxygen, which is an electronegative atom, and the hydrogen atom that is attached to the nitrogen, which is also an electronegative atom. That's what's going on in proteins. So if you see in my illustration here, you've got two proteins, and they're very short. But what you'll notice is, you'll notice like on the left-hand side, up at the top, you'll see a double-bonded oxygen. There's your electronegative oxygen. Is hydrogen-bonded down to the hydrogen right below it that is covalently bound to the nitrogen molecule. That's your hydrogen bond. And then to the right of that, you'll see the same thing except in reverse, where the hydrogen is bound up on the top, the hydrogen is bound covalently to the nitrogen, and then it is hydrogen bonded across to the double bonded oxygen in the molecule below. So that's really critical. That's how it works. Now, when we put it all together, check it out. In the next slide, here you go. This hydrogen bonding will result in two kinds of folding. One is an alpha helix. And you can see the alpha helix here. It's just, it looks like a spiral. And the alpha helix is due to a very specific form of hydrogen bonding. It's the hydrogen bonding between every fourth amino acid. And if you count it, you'll see. That's what's happening. And just look, you'll see the double bonded oxygen, you know, hydrogen bonded to the hydrogen that's covalently bonded to the nitrogen. And then you go, and they're four amino acids apart. Okay, and that causes the spiraling. Now, we'll just do a little trivial pursuit here, some kind of cool factoids. Does anyone know who discovered the alpha? You can only answer if you have not read the notes yet or you don't have the notes in front of you. Does anyone know who discovered the alpha helix? I'll give you some clues. This person was a professor at Caltech, and he won the Nobel Prize in chemistry. And this was one of the things that led to his Nobel Prize. Okay, he also won a second Nobel Prize in peace. So not only did he win a chemistry one, he won a Nobel Prize in peace. He's probably considered, he might be considered the greatest chemist of the 20th century. Okay, I'll give you another clue. He's dead now. Okay. He died in his 90s, but let me tell you one more thing. He advocated during the last years of his life, maybe the last 20 or 30 years, he got on this whole thing about taking a particular mega vitamin that would, he said, prevent you from getting sick, like the common cold and so forth. Does anybody know what that vitamin is that he advocated? Vitamin C, exactly. So he's the one that got on this thing about vitamin C. Does anybody know who he is now? Nobody. Okay. Well, his name is Linus Pauling. And if you never heard about him, he's super famous. And he lived into his 90s. And the data on vitamin C is real interesting. There's some studies that show that it works, some studies that show that it doesn't work. So the jury's still out. But if you want to take one data point, Linus Pauling, he lived into his 90s. So who knows? Maybe it works. Or maybe it's just the placebo effect. He thought it worked, and it did for him. I don't know. Okay. The other form of secondary structure is on the right here. It's called the beta-pleated sheet. And what you see here is that the hydrogen bonding, instead of causing a spiral shape, you get a pleated shape, and it's kind of like a sheet. And what's interesting is these two structures, these two secondary structures, will be found embedded in larger tertiary structures. So in the next slide, that purple molecule that you see up there, that it looks like a ribbon, is really a really long protein that is bound, you know, is sort of all wrapped up in what we call a tertiary structure. But within that tertiary structure, you will see little spirals. Those spirals are alpha helixes or helices. And then you can see a beta-pleated sheet there as well. And so you'll see these secondary structures embedded in larger tertiary structures. So that leads us to tertiary structures. So the tertiary structure is folding due to the R group interactions. And now remember, secondary structure is not due to the R groups, okay? Tertiary is. And there's a whole bunch of interactions, which I'm just going to list here. Hydrophobic interactions, where the nonpolar R groups like to get close together, and they like to get away from water. You got van der Waals forces, which are also nonpolar R group interactions. You got hydrogen bonds between R groups. You get ionic bonds. You guys know about ions. And disulfide bridges, which are sulfur to sulfur bonds, and they're actually covalent bonds. They're the strongest of the R group interactions. And what they end up causing to happen is you get this maybe long protein, let's say it's 300, 400, 500, 600, 700 amino acids long. As soon as it's constructed, it will immediately fold up in this crazy, you know, and I'm making this weird three-dimensional shape like this. And you go like, well, how does it get that crazy shape? You know, that like, you know, here I am all wrapped up in this weird ball, okay? Well, it's all the R groups trying to do what they do. The nonpolar ones are trying to get away from water. The ionic ones are trying to form ionic bonds. The disulfide bridges are, you know, and as a result of all that, the net effect is this crazy three-dimensional structure. Does that make sense to you guys? Okay, and that's what we call tertiary structure. And we can look, and this is on this next slide, it shows you all the different bonds and, you know, sort of in a very schematic way, but then you can see below, you know, what they'll result, you know, in. And these are more sort of, they're cool computer renderings of this. Let me go ahead to this, I'm going to show a protein folding animation. So this little website will just, it's very, very simple. It's a simple little animation, but it just kind of shows you how this works. And so you're going to see in just a minute on the screen, if we can get to this website, you'll actually see a protein go through a folding process. Maybe not. Okay. It looks like we're not going to go there. So what you can do is tonight you can go on the website and the link will be there and you can check it out. It's a cool little folding thing that happens. Let's go back to the lecture. Oh, actually, there it was. Started. Of course, now I can't get back to it. There it is. Yeah. So here's the protein folding simulation. So if we just, you know, say go. This is a protein. You can see that it has the primary structure is just the sequence of the proteins. And what they say down here is they say the spheres represent amino acids in a protein chain. It says the red spheres represent amino acids with hydrophobic side chains, so they want to avoid water. The purple and blue spheres represent amino acids that can form hydrogen bonds with each other's side chains. yellow and green spheres represent amino acids that can form ionic bonds with each other's side chains. And then as you play this little animation, you'll see how it folds up to satisfy everybody's wishes. And we'll just go on. You can look at that tonight, though. I suggest you take a look at it. Pretty cool. Okay, quaternary structure is when two or more polypeptides are linked together. And they're usually held together by R-group interactions. These are the same R-group interactions that we just talked about, except instead of causing the tertiary structure, they're holding the two structures together. And an example is collagen, which you see here on the right. And collagen are three different proteins that are held together by these interactions with one another, as you can see here. And 40% of the protein in the human body is actually this particular protein. It's a quaternary protein. And it strengthens connective tissues in skin, bones, ligaments, tendons, and so forth. Another famous quaternary structure is hemoglobin, and it's actually four tertiary polypeptide subunits, and you can see them, they're colored differently in each here, and they're each subunit can bind with an oxygen molecule, and this large quaternary protein is found in red blood cells, and it transports oxygen to all the cells in the body. But you can see here that these four subunits are held together, and when they are, it's a quaternary structure. And once again, there's another protein folding animation, which I'll let you look at on your own tonight. Now, how do you mess up a protein? This is important. The way you mess up a protein, remember, since the structure, once again, we're going to come back to this key idea I told you, because structure of a protein dictates its function, if you somehow mess up this structure, then it will no longer function properly. And when you change the structure of a protein, when you kind of mess it up, we have a word for this. It's called denaturing the protein, okay? So there's two important ways that we can mess up a protein. One of them is to heat it. When you heat up the protein, it will break the bonds and it will unravel it, as you see here in the illustration. And once you unravel it, well, there you go. You've got a new structure, so the function no longer works. Also, you can radically change the pH, and the way to do that is to stick it in acid or base, and that also causes an unraveling of the protein. And this is why, this is interesting, this is why living systems have buffers. Remember that buffers, remember from chemistry, they are chemicals that will resist the pH, the change in pH. And so living systems can't afford to have their pH change very much, or else their proteins will denature. So as soon as proteins denature, they no longer function properly. And since proteins control just about everything in living systems, the organism will die. So you really can't mess with your proteins. And so that's why we keep pretty much a constant temperature all the time. You can't heat us up, or you're going to start denaturing our proteins, and then our entire metabolism is going to fall apart. Okay. Finally, I have this final slide, which is a really nice summary of everything I just told you. On the left, you'll see the different levels of protein structure, primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary. Then you have a description of what each of those represents, and then you see what kind of bonds are formed, and then you have an example on the right. So this is like one-stop shopping. You go here, all your information's there. It's all summarized in one beautiful graphic. This graphic is not from your book, it's from another book that I think does a better job of illustrating everything in one slide. So that's why I put it in this lecture. Okay, that's it.